It is fascinating that a New Yorker had not only heard of the settlement, but had heard of it often in 1893. Scott allows that while the natives sometimes bring vegetables in to sell, I have never thought of going to see them. Chastised by her cousin for not showing her this obvious point of interest during a tour of Mobile, Scott says, "Come, we will be two Mrs. Sheldons and start even now to penetrate Africa." This last is a reference to May French Sheldon, who famously led an expedition through Kenya in 1891, without the assistance or companionship of white or black men or women above the rank of servitors. Sheldon's trip was inspired by family friend Henry Morton Stanley of Dr. Livingstone, I presume, fame. At the height of the Victorian era, Americans were fascinated by Africa, and Sheldon was the toast of the world by 1893, after a lecture tour and the publication of her travel accounts. One of the primary reasons she gives for her journey was having ever flouted in my face the supercilious edict that it was outside the limitation of woman's legitimate province. It was blind luck, according to Scott, that their carriage driver for their trip to penetrate Africa ended up being Noah Hart, by then an old man. He was recommended by her houseboy, who said Noah was about the onliest driver what knows the way. The resulting article is one of the only sources with any information about the Clotilda captives' first days as slaves, and of Mayer's early efforts to hide the arrival of the ship from the government. The article is also unique for the vivid picture it paints of African Town circa 1893. Scott's first question for Noah was whether he thought two women would be safe going to the community.
Perfectly safe, miss, he responded.
As the carriage approached the settlement, Noah warned the ladies, "You mustn't expect to see nothing no way uncommon, ladies. You know the Africans lives just about like American niggas now." As they reached the top of a hill, down through the valley and up on the slope of the hill beyond were dotted little cabins. Sometimes two or three would be huddled together. Then again, one would stand out far from the rest. Each had its little patch of flower garden, its clambering vines, and its vegetable garden of potatoes, corn, tobacco, and watermelons. As we jogged on past dilapidated fences and unattractive cabins, we came to one rather worse than the others, where a bent old woman with a head as white as snow was hoeing among the melon vines. Noah attempted to draw the woman into conversation, offering to buy melons from her garden. This was almost certainly a woman named Zuma, by then a widow and something of a hermit. Roche's description of her, though unkind, with its descriptions of many pounds of superfluous flesh, may be accurate. She sits for the most part silent and brooding in her squalid hut. Brooding, she is pathetic. Aroused and speaking of home, she is tragic. Roche said her English was barely intelligible compared to her shipmates. She walked slowly toward us with her keen eyes fixed on our faces, but some feet inside of her rickety gait she stopped, and no amount of wheedling brought her a step nearer. I suppose that she had sized us up and made up her mind that we had called for curiosity rather than melons, and her dignity was therefore offended, wrote Scott. It is telling that sightseers were common enough for Zuma to recognize one when she saw them, and that she stared at them with enough menace for Scott to register that the woman was offended by the objectifying attention. Henry Romaine, an army captain, visited the village a few years after Mary McNeil Scott, perhaps drawn by her article. At the time, he was told that about 40 of the original Africans remained. He found that about 30 small houses are scattered irregularly over an area of 40 or 50 acres. Many of them quite comfortable structures compared with ordinary cabins of the country. When he visited the group at church, he said they were fully as well dressed as are the majority of laboring people, white or black, in their locality. And most of them had in their appearance and surrounding an air of substantial physical well-being none too common in the laboring class in that section of the country. Perhaps Romaine's most prescient comment was, "Any romance connected with them is fast fading away, and with the passing of the original members of the colony from the scenes of action, it will have ceased to exist, and their descendants will be merged into the ordinary colored inhabitants of the section where they reside." After more than 3 decades in Alabama,
That very thing had already started to happen in Africatown as the founders began to die off and more of their children married American-born blacks. We can see that this loss of Africanness had already begun in some measure by the time Noah Hart took Mary McNeil Scott to visit Afiki Town. From the interview with Hart, we know that when the Africans first arrived, they danced frequently to express both sorrow and joy. We know they performed African-style burials. We know they continued ceremonies surrounding the new moon and the arrival of new children, the worship of weather events such as thunderstorms. What we don't know is precisely when those things disappeared. Cujo hints at it when discussing the death of his first child in 1893. We Christian people now. So we put our baby in the coffin and they take her into church and everybody come look down in her face. They sing, "Shall we meet beyond a river?" I've been a member of the church a long time now and I know the words of the song with my mouth, but my heart it don't know that. Therefore I sing inside me, "O todo a wan la yali, auran kani rara kani ro ro." 33 years after he arrived in Mobile, Cujo is censoring himself, keeping the African death chant he grew up with locked in his heart while singing an American version out loud. Cujo's only daughter died in August of 1893 at the age of 15. In coastal Alabama, July and August are high time for mosquitoes, due to the very tropical wet season, with daily thunderstorms most afternoons. From Cujo's description of the teenager taking to her bed and slowly withering despite various prescriptions from a doctor, it sounds like she may have succumbed to either yellow fever or malaria. Both remained widespread in Mobile into the 1920s, until window screens became common. Cujo lamented the first time, "Death find where my door is, but we from cross the water know that he come in the ship with us. Her mama take it so hard. I try telling her not to cry, but I cry too." In Bonte, a Yoruba family would have buried their daughter under the hard-packed dirt floor of the home or under the entranceway of the house. It was a way of keeping the dead close, where they could still be loved and safe from harm. We know from Noah Hart's first-hand account that when the Africans arrived, they buried their dead using traditional African methods. Burying the teenager in the new cemetery next to their church was hard for Cujo and his wife, even though they could see the grave from their porch. But it had to be done, he said, because they had become Christians, and that's what Christians did. "We bury her in the family lot. She looky so lonesome out there by herself. She's such a little girl," Cujo said. He quickly built a fence around her grave so she would have protection out in the lonely cemetery. His wife would often sit by the grave. During the coming years, death and hardship would remain frequent visitors for Cujo's family. They would encounter voter intimidation, racial violence, prison, and murder, even at the hands of law enforcement. By the 1890s, Alabama led the nation in lynchings, with 177 documented cases in the decade. The state steadily passed a series of ever more regressive state constitutions, each taking a little more freedom away from African Americans. The Constitution adopted in 1901 and still in force today, with many modifications forced by the federal civil rights laws, was designed specifically to disenfranchise them. John Knox, an Alabama lawyer who led the Constitutional Convention where the document was drafted, confessed as much during the convention. "If we would have white supremacy, we must establish it by law, not by force or fraud," Knox said. He blamed the inferior intelligence and moral failings of the state's non-white population. As he explained in his opening remarks at the convention, whites should rule because there is in the white man an inherited capacity of government, which is wholly wanting in the Negro. Before the art of reading and writing was known, the ancestors of the Anglo-Saxon had established an orderly system of government. The Negro, on the other hand, is descended from a race of lowest in intelligence and moral perceptions of all the races of men. The Constitution, as adopted, established a requirement for residency in order to vote, along with a poll tax of $1.50 a year, the ability to read and write in English, and personal property worth at least $300, or the ownership of at least 40 acres of land. The effects of the new constitution were immediate and profound. In 1900, there were 181,000 African Americans registered to vote in the state. In 1903, there were just 5,000. The residents of African Town were among those who lost out. The Lewis Klan's experiences in the decades before and after 1890 mirrored what African Americans faced across the South after emancipation. Several of the major incidents revolved around Cujo's boys, five in all. Cujo said the children of American-born blacks called his children cannibals, ignorant savages, and kin to monkeys. These were all insults that would be hurled at African Americans for the next 100 years, no matter where they were born. Cujo said his boys had no choice but to defend themselves against the attacks. The words hurt their feelings, so they fought, and fought hard. Though it is left unsaid, it is a safe bet that Cujo taught his children, including his youngest son and namesake, Cujo Jr., to defend themselves with the techniques he'd learned during his 5 years of training as a warrior. "When dey whip the other boys, dey folks come to our house and telly us, 'Yo boys mighty bad, Cujo. We 'fraid they go and kill somebody,'" Cujo recalled. Dealing with the angry parents of kids who'd been beaten up, he likened his sons to rattlesnakes. "If you bother with him, he bites you. If you know the snake killy you, why you bother with him? Same way with my boys." But the parents kept coming. All the time, Alec this, Jimmy that, Polly this and the other. "David a bad boy. Cujo fighty my son. Nobody never say what they do to the Afiki savages." This pattern of violence continued as the boys became adults. Son Cujo Jr. became the owner of a grocery store, a prosperous and prominent occupation for an African American in Alabama at the turn of the century. He was well regarded by both blacks and whites in the community. For reasons unknown, he killed a man in 1899, Gilbert Thomas, who may have been his brother-in-law. Earlier in the same year, Cujo Jr. had married a woman named Louisa Thomas, though it is unclear if she was related to Gilbert, the murdered man. Any police reports that may have existed describing the murder have long since disappeared, and neither Cujo Sr. nor any of the Africans ever spoke of it. We know that Cujo Jr. was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 5 years in the state prison. During that time, he was enrolled in Alabama's notorious convict leasing system. The system came into existence in 1875 when the state faced a serious cash shortage. Alabama decided at that point to rent its prisoners to railroads, coal mine owners, and other heavy industry. The arrangement proved so profitable for the state, which simply handed the prisoners over to industry and let the companies feed and house them, that by 1883, a new arrangement had been made. Nearly all of the state's inmates were leased to three coal mining companies for a few dollars a month per prisoner. A Convict Bureau document from 1900 describes Cujo Jr. as a second-class prisoner at Pratt Mines, earning the state $10 per month from the mining company for his labor. As a second-class prisoner, Cujo Jr. was expected to dig 3 tons of coal a day from rock seams deep underground. Prisoners who didn't meet their quota were subject to 40 to 50 lashes with a wide leather strap. The shackled miners were carried underground each morning, riding into the bowels of the earth in mining carts on the narrow gauge tram system used to haul the coal to the surface. Equipped with picks, sledgehammers, and iron wedges to pry chunks of coal loose, the men worked by the light of tiny oil lanterns fastened to leather straps they wore around their heads. When Cujo Jr. wasn't underground, he was kept chained with 200 other prisoners in a crowded bunkhouse where tuberculosis and other diseases were rampant. 30% of the prisoners died each year. The system would continue until 1928 and is infamous for the abuses heaped on convicts. In 1900, the year Cujo Jr. was imprisoned, the state reaped $400,000 from the program, the equivalent of about $13 million today. Conditions for the inmates were horrific. They worked 12-hour days underground in unventilated mines where they were choked on coal dust and were vulnerable to tunnel collapses, explosions, faulty elevators, and asphyxiation by pockets of deadly hydrogen sulfide gas, not to mention the whippings and other tortures documented at the mines. Cujo Jr.'s story was an unusual one. After a lobbying campaign involving law enforcement officers and community leaders, black and white, he received a pardon from the governor after just 1 year underground. In the petition for the pardon, which was supported by 10 of the 12 jurors who'd convicted Cujo Jr. of manslaughter, his lawyer writes, "The present sheriff tells me Lewis is a good Negro, that he was of great service to the officers of the law in the apprehension of criminals, and was always a peaceful, law-abiding citizen in every respect." Other documents reveal that Cujo Jr. served as an informer for the sheriff, helping him and his deputies in ferreting out crime and arresting criminals of his own race. Those documents also describe Gilbert Thomas, the man Cujo Jr. killed, as a desperate, dangerous, turbulent, and bloodthirsty scoundrel whose taking off was an unspeakable blessing to the community in which he lived. He was a perambulating arsenal of homicidal fury and destruction. A letter included in the pardon petition was signed by some of Mobile's most prominent citizens, including the sheriff. The first signature on the letter is that of Augustine Mayer, son of Timothy Mayer. Cujo Jr.'s reprieve was as brief as it was rare. 2 years later, in 1902, he was shot through the throat by an African-American sheriff's deputy. He lingered in bed for 2 days at the Lewis home, his breath wheezing through a gaping hole in his neck. His mama never leave him. She looky at his face and telly him, "Put whip to your horse, baby," Cujo remembered. "I pray so hard, but he die. I so sad I wish I could die in place of my Cujo. Maybe I don't pray right, you understand me? 'Cause he die while I was praying that the Lord spare my boy life." Though she did not include the story in Barracoon, Zora Neale Hurston's notes included a description of what she believed happened, which she acknowledged was sketchy at best. Of one fact, she was certain. The community in general feared the Lewis boys. Her sources said there had been multiple fights between Cujo's sons and another group in the community spread over months. This led up to a bloody confrontation on July 28, 1902. One man was shot to death and another suffered a grievous knife wound. Young Cujo was said to have done both the cutting and the shooting when set upon by some of his enemies. Hurston's notes suggest a sheriff's deputy had been trying to arrest Cujo for 3 weeks, but was afraid of the confrontation. Unable to catch him off guard, the deputy hid behind the butcher's wagon when the butcher arrived to deliver meat. As Cujo Jr. stepped out from his shop to settle with the butcher, the deputy shot him from his hiding place. There are no records of an arrest warrant or a charge against the younger Cujo, and his father went to his grave believing his son had been murdered. "He say he the law, but he don't come rest him. If my boy done something wrong, it his place come rest him like a man. If he mad with my Cujo about something, then he ought come fight him face to face like a man. He have words with my boy, but he scared face him," Cujo said. "Dis man, he hiding hisself in the back of the wagon and shooting my boy. He make out he scared my boy gonna shoot him and shooting my boy down in the store." The deputy became the pastor of a church in the area, but never apologized to Cujo for killing his son. Not long after the death of his second child, Cujo himself had been badly injured when he was hit by a train while driving his buckboard wagon to Mobile to buy beans to plant in his garden in 1902. He was flung from the wagon, and his horse ran away. A white woman was among those who came to his aid at the scene and made sure he was taken to a doctor's office. Cujo was bedridden for 14 days and given morphine to dull the pain of broken ribs and other injuries. The woman sent a basket of food and then came to visit Cujo at his home, connecting him to a lawyer and urging him to sue the railroad. The woman's identity remains a mystery, though I suspect she was Emma Roche, who first captured the African story for history. Roche's family was a prominent one in Mobile. Her father was a Confederate war hero and a prosperous funeral director, and the family mansion, which also housed the Roche mortuary business, still sits on Government Street, where Cujo was hit by the train. Emma traveled broadly in her early years and studied at an art school in Manhattan. Her family had interacted with several of the Africans who worked for her father for years, and they knew the African's unique history before Cujo's accident. When she spoke to him in the aftermath, she would have recognized his accent and linked him to Gumpa and the others employed as gravediggers. It seems likely that this was when she and Cujo struck up the close friendship that would last the rest of their lives. For an illiterate African to go up against the behemoth L&N Railroad was unusual, especially with a lawsuit for $5,000. The railroad's lawyer blamed Cujo for not noticing the train before it hit him. But the jury was not moved by this argument, as multiple witnesses testified that the train never blew its whistle or rang its bell before barreling through the downtown intersection where Cujo was hit. They had him remove his clothes in court to display his injuries, and a doctor testified that he was crippled for life and wouldn't be able to work at the mill any longer. In a surprise verdict, he was awarded $650, but his white lawyer, a member of Mobile's society set, kept stalling when Cujo asked for the money. Within a year, the attorney died of yellow fever, and Cujo never received a dime of his settlement. The congregation of the old Landmark Baptist Church named Cujo sexton, or caretaker. Just a few months later, Gumpa, who had been the leader of the village for 3 decades, was also hit by a train. He succumbed to his injuries within a week, leading the group to elevate Charlie Lewis to the role of leader. Death became a frequent visitor at Cujo's house in 1905. David, the second youngest son, told his parents one afternoon he was headed to Mobile to pick up some shirts he'd had laundered. Hours later, he was found dead on the railroad tracks 5 miles in the opposite direction from where he had said he was going. He had been beheaded. When neighbors carried the body to Cujo's house on an old window shutter, he refused to believe it was his son because the head was missing. Then someone walked up carrying a box with David's head in it. Celia began wailing. Cujo reached inside his son's shirt and felt for the scarification marks they had put on his chest when he was a baby. Once he felt them, he knew it was his son. Cujo leapt from the porch and raced into the forest, finally tripping and falling on his face. Some of those who had come across the water came to find me and brought him home. 3 of Cujo and Celia's children were now buried in the cemetery by his home. His son Poli, named after Poli Allen, was furious. One brother had been murdered by the deputy, and now another found dead in mysterious circumstances along the railroad tracks. His father had been hit by a train, only to have the court-ordered settlement stolen by his white lawyer. Poli told his parents he wanted to move to Africa. A few weeks later, he said he was going fishing in the creek down the hill from the house. Cujo and the others kept dugout canoes they had made in the African way on the creek bank. He never came home. Cujo told Hurston he hoped Poli had decided to run away to Africa, but he was afraid someone had killed him too. "So many de folks, they hate my boy 'cause he lack his brothers. They don't let nobody abuse them like they dogs. Maybe he in the Afiki soil, like somebody say. Poor Cujo lonesome for him, but Cujo don't know." Then in November, Cujo's son Jimmy came home for work and said he didn't feel well. A doctor was called, but Jimmy was dead within 2 days. He died holding Cujo's hand. 5 of the Lewis children were now buried in the little cemetery on the hill. Only their oldest child, Alec, was still alive, living next door to his parents with his wife and children. "I good to my chillen," Cujo said. "I want they company, but looky like they lonesome for one another." So they hurry go sleep together in the graveyard. 3 years passed, just Cujo and Celia living in their little cabin. The house was full, but now it empty. "We old folks now, and we know we ain't going have no more chillen. We so lonesome, but we know we can't get it back to dead. When the spit goes from the mouth, it don't come back. When the earth eats, it don't give back." One night, Celia woke Cujo to tell him she'd had a dream that their children were cold. When they were little, he said she would often get up in the night to check on them and make sure they had enough quilts to keep warm. The next morning, she asked him to accompany her to the graveyard to check on the children. Cujo said he would, but then disappeared to go clean the church, hoping she'd forget about visiting the cemetery, because he knew it would upset her. When he came outside, he spied her on the hillside, moving among the graves. I see Seely going from one her chilling grave to the other, like she covered him up with more quilts. A week later, she died and was buried alongside her children. A month after that, her oldest son, Alec, died in December of 1908, also under mysterious circumstances. Cujo's last child took his place with the others on the hillside. "Did I just like I come from the Africa soil?" Cujo told Hurston, meaning both alone and lonesome. "I got nobody but the daughter-in-law, Mary, and the grandchildren." It may have been the death of Cujo's wife that brought Roche back into his orbit, or maybe she'd been a regular presence for the 6 years since the train accident. She describes the scene at Cujo's home the Sunday after his wife was buried. The last of the Africans gathered together and told stories about their homeland, chattering quietly in their native language, and Cujo made a parable about his wife's death, explaining she got off the train they were riding unexpectedly. "She say goodbye, Cujo, I hate to leave you, but she get off." Leaving him, still journeying on. He was bereft. Oh, Lord, Lord. The wife she the eyes to the man's soul. How can I see now when I ain't got the eyes no more? The gathering of the elders was repeated the following Sunday, again at Cujo's home. Roche says the last of the Clotilda captives met this way every Sunday, either at Cujo's, Poli's, or Abache's. They gathered to speak their native language with the last of their kind, talking and taking care of one another. "I appreciate my countrymen, they come see me when they know I lonely." When he sits with Roche in these later years, she finds him warm and quick with a laugh. The old man is cheerful, even merry, possessing a keen sense of humor and a lively imagination. To appreciate him fully, he must be surprised at his home. There he will be found probably working in his garden barefooted, trousers rolled up above his knees. His costume clean, but a marvelous piece of patchwork, even the old derby upon his head a much mended one. Roche does not mean insult when she remarks on his clothes. Cujo loved to sew. He did all of the family's mending at night after work. This harkens back to life in Bante, and in the Yoruba culture, where sewing is traditionally a man's job. I witnessed as much as I traveled around modern-day Benin. In small storefronts, under shady trees, even in mud huts, I saw men hunched over old-fashioned sewing machines, turning out dresses and men's suits. Cujo summed up his loneliness by explaining that God gave people 6 limbs so they could live. 2 hands, 2 feet, and 2 eyes. "I say they cut off the feet, he got hands to fend himself. They cut off the hands, he wiggle out the way when he see danger come. But when he lose the eye, then he can't see nothing come upon him. He finished. My boys is my feet. My daughter is my hands. My wife, she my eye. She left, Cujo finished." Age 67, suddenly on his own, his injuries from the train accident meant he could no longer handle farming the large tracts of land he'd accumulated around his home. He sold off the first piece shortly after his wife's death and slowly parted with other pieces to replace his lost income. He spent the next 27 years awash in his loneliness, his only source of joy being his grandchildren and then great-grandchildren, who were constant companions. They read the Bible to him, and he grew sugarcane in his small garden so he'd always have something sweet to give them. A photograph of him sitting by the fire in his home around this time shows walls made of pine planks gone dark with age and soot. One wall is covered in newsprint used as wallpaper. 3 photographs hang on the wall. 1 is of a couple, perhaps Cujo and his beloved wife. 3 straw hats, each looking fairly new and in the boater style popular in the 1920s, hang on nails. Around the fireplace, crumpled wads of newspaper are shoved in cracks between the wood walls and the stones of the hearth. A few spider webs are visible against the dark wood planking. A kerosene lamp and a wind-up clock are perched on the cluttered mantel. Several large iron pots are stacked on the hearth, indicating Cujo cooks over the fire, rather than on a wood stove. A wicker rocking chair is heaped with clothes and paper bags. While Cujo's cabin was primitive, Africatown was not. Rising alongside several other black-governed communities around the country, it became a magnet, pulling in African-Americans from all over Alabama and beyond. Some of these largest African-American communities advertised themselves in nationwide publications, attempting to draw residents. In advertisements in various publications, Boley, Oklahoma, billed itself as a progressive Negro town with schools, churches, and a business district. Mound Bayou, Mississippi, bragged that with its newspaper, telephone system, and electric lights, it provided all the amenities of a modern country town for a man with brains and vision. For Africatown, news coverage surrounding the death of Timothy Mayer and subsequent visits by Booker T. Washington and other celebrities of the day did the advertising. The Negro Yearbook and Annual Encyclopedia of the Negro, put out every year by the Tuskegee Institute, documented the community's rise. In 1912, it was listed as one of 30 towns nationwide that were governed by blacks, with a population of 200, though in the listing the town is called Plateau. By 1921, just 9 years later, the population had grown to 1,500, making it the fourth largest African-American governed community in the nation. The fast growth from the few dozen families that founded the town and were its first residents to a community where American-born blacks far outnumbered the original African inhabitants meant that the longtime system of governance, with a leader and judges chosen from among the original Africans, simply disappeared under the weight of the burgeoning population. The remaining Africans, fewer than 10 by 1921, did not hold significant influence over the hundreds of new families. They were treated as respected elders by the community, but not so respected that the newcomers agreed to live under the community rules established at the town's founding, or abide by decisions rendered by the trio of old men whom the original Africans still followed as their leaders. As the last Africans moved into old age, their children and grandchildren continued to work for the mayors at the mill and shipyard, and farm the properties their parents were leaving behind. Photographs of the scenes along Mobile's waterfront at the time show not much had changed from the Civil War days. Stacks of lumber waiting to be shipped out, warehouses stuffed with bales of cotton, huge quantities of South American bananas being unloaded onto the wharves, and a lot of African-American laborers doing the work. Since Timothy's death in 1892, the mayor's various businesses had expanded, and the mill and timber business were still major employers for the growing population of Africatown. Augustine Mayer, Timothy's son, now ruled his father's empire, though the original plantation house had long since burned down. When the third schoolhouse built by the Africans since 1880 burned down under mysterious circumstances in the mid-1920s, the community turned to a program started by Booker T. Washington that provided grants to schools for African Americans. In 1927, the school started by the Africans, then known as the Plateau Normal and Industrial Institute for the Education of the Head, Heart, and Hands of the Colored Youth, received a grant from the Rosenwald Fund to build a new, much larger school with 10 classrooms and living quarters for 10 teachers. The fund was the brainchild of Booker T. Washington and Julius Rosenwald, the CEO of Sears Roebuck & Company. The pair met in Chicago in 1911, after Rosenwald attended a speech by Washington. Rosenwald, whose fortune would have ranked him as a billionaire by today's standards, was looking for a philanthropic cause to answer what he believed were the special duties that capitalists and men of wealth owed to society. Rosenwald provided an endowment for Washington's Tuskegee Institute and embraced Washington's dream of funding schools across the South to teach what the educator described as industrial education. The minute it was seen that through industrial education, the Negro youth was not only studying chemistry, but also how to apply the knowledge of chemistry to the enrichment of the soil, or to cooking, or to dairying, and that the student was being taught not only geometry and physics, but their application to blacksmithing, brickmaking, farming, and whatnot, then there began to appear for the first time a common bond between the two races. The first six schools the pair funded, thanks to a $25,000 grant from Rosenwald, were built in rural Alabama hamlets in 1914. By 1932, the fund had spent $28 million to construct 4,977 schools across the South and 217 houses or dormitories for the teachers, including the 10 teachers in Africatown. Washington was dead by the time the Africatown school received its grant of $4,800. The money allowed the school to significantly expand and saw it renamed Mobile County Training School. In Alabama, the phrase training school meant a high school for blacks. The new Africatown school, built on the spot where Cujo asked Timothy Mayer to give the Africans some land, was the first and only high school for African Americans in all of Mobile, and the first one to receive official certification by the state of Alabama. Of the 5,000 schools built with Rosenwald grants, only the school in Africatown is still open and teaching students. Meanwhile, one of the most consequential changes to Africatown since its founding occurred right outside Cujo's front door the same year when he and several of his shipmates were compelled to sell some of their land to the city of Mobile for the construction of a road. The road bisected the properties of many of the Clotilda families and was attached to a new drawbridge built in 1927 that crossed the Mobile River and landed right in the heart of Africatown. Its creation was coupled with construction of an earthen berm laid all the way across the top of Mobile Bay's marshy estuary for a new road. It connected Mobile for the first time by road to the growing cities on the other side of Mobile Bay, including Daphne, Spanish Fort, and Fairhope. Previously, the only way across the bay was an 8-mile boat ride. More important than connecting these local communities, the bridge was also part of US 90, then the only highway that ran along the Gulf Coast, connecting Alabama to Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, and beyond. The bridge was a big deal for the city of Mobile. It meant visiting the city no longer required making a long detour far out of the way for people traveling along the coast. Instead, the coastal highway now came through the city. Everyone heading through Mobile on the new highway had to drive right through Africatown on the newly paved road, passing within a few yards of the homes of Cujo and Africatown's other original leaders, as well as the community's church and the cemetery. The road also crossed the swampy areas that had always isolated the peninsula that Africatown and the Mayer properties sat on, meaning the trip to Mobile was suddenly much faster. This would change Africatown in a profound way. The community situated out on the end of a peninsula was instantly transformed from the equivalent of a cul-de-sac, a road that leads nowhere else, to a crossroads connected to places far and wide. The change also meant the mayor's extensive waterfront holdings along the Mobile River were suddenly accessible to major industry. Within 2 years of the bridge's installation, Augustine Gus Mayer, grandson of Timothy, made a deal that made his family even richer and would set Africatown's course for decades. He leased about 100 acres along the riverfront to International Paper Company to build what would become one of the largest paper mills in the world and the company's global headquarters. The factory was built within shouting distance of people's houses in Africatown. As construction on the mill began, Zora Neale Hurston visited Cujo for a last time in 1928. By the time the smokestacks of the new factory emerged above the tops of his fruit trees, Cujo was the last African living in Africatown. Hurston asked to take his picture, which Cujo agreed to, but only after he changed clothes. He emerged from the house wearing his best suit, but no shoes. Hurston asked why. "I want to look like I in Africa, 'cause that where I want to be." All of his shipmates had passed away within the last few years. He and Radoshi, who lived a few hours away by train, were known to have continued visiting each other after all the other Clotilda captives had died. She would have been the last person Cujo spoke to in his native tongue, probably in 1932. In these last years, he was visited frequently by reporters. One remembered that the present of a dime or two bits would refresh his memory regarding the past. His celebrity was such that a New York promoter offered a generous sum for Cujo to appear as the star attraction in a vaudeville review in the city. At that point, he had lived in his one-room cabin for 75 years and only spent two nights away from it in all that time. He had no interest in seeing New York or leaving his house or the graveyard out front, where his wife, children, and shipmates were buried. Cujo had never learned to read and write. For the last 27 years of his life, night would close in on the old man mending pants by lamplight. Nothing to keep his memories at bay but the dozens of Bible verses he had memorized. He spoke openly to everyone he encountered about the awful loneliness he felt in these last years, including in several public events put on in Mobile where Cujo told his story and spoke and sang in his native tongue in packed auditoriums. He would fall to tears recounting the story of his capture and the destruction of his village, or his worry over his son Poli, whose body was never found. After he was too weak to be about, when I called to see him, the doors and windows would be closed tight. Roche wrote in an obituary for the Mobile newspaper. Opening a door, I'd call, "Cujo," and out of the gloom, a low moan and a "Thank God" would answer me. The last time Roche called on her old friend, shortly before he died at 94, an old one-eyed man was helping care for him. His widowed daughter-in-law Mary and her children, who still lived in a house Cujo and the Africans had helped his son Alec build on the property three decades earlier, brought him food. Roche's arrival brought tears to his eyes as he raised his head toward the heavens and exclaimed, "Lord, God, I thank thee that I see her once again." His mind remained keen until the end, but his worn body was scarcely up to sitting in a rocking chair. Since his conversion to Christianity in 1869, Cujo would point to the sky and say that when he died, "I want to go yonder." His last words to Roche as she left his house for the final time were, "When they tell you Cujo is dead, say no, Cujo is not dead. He has gone to heaven to rest." The last of the Africa Town settlers went yonder on July 26, 1935. He was buried in the hillside graveyard just beyond his front door, next to his wife, children, and shipmates.